Hello, and welcome to Page Turn, the Largo Public Library podcast. I'm your host, Hannah. Page Turn is a monthly podcast bringing you information about great books, library news, and fun library tidbits from your favorite programs, as well as a Spanish language book review from Victor. But as always, we start with Reader's Advisory. Finally, a novel that puts the pissed back into epistolary. Jason Fitger is a beleaguered professor of creative writing and literature at Payne University, a small and not very distinguished liberal arts college in the Midwest. His department is facing draconian cuts and squalid quarters, while one floor above them, the economics department, is getting lavishly remodeled offices. His once promising writing career is in the doldrums, as is his romantic life, in part as the result of his unwise use of his private affairs for his novels. His star, he thinks, student, can't catch a break with his brilliant, he thinks, work, accountant in a bordello, based on Melville's Bartleby. In short, his life is a tale of woe, and the vehicle this droll and inventive novel uses to tell that tale is a series of hilarious letters of recommendation that Fitger is endlessly called upon by his students and colleagues to produce, each one of which is a small masterpiece of high dudgeon, low spirits, and passive-aggressive strategies. Today's Reader's Advisory is Dear Committee Members by Julie Schumacher. Dear Committee Members is a series of letters, each varying in different levels of formality. This novel is a wicked satire of academia and Midwest life, and the tone varies from cynical and bitter, from wildly hopeful to desperate. Readers may also enjoy The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay by Michael Chabon. Joe Cavalier, a young Jewish artist who has also been trained in the art of Houdini-esque escape, has just smuggled himself out of Nazi-invaded Prague and landed in New York City. His Brooklyn cousin, Sammy Clay, is looking for a partner to create heroes, stories, and art for the latest novelty to hit America, the comic book. Drawing on their own fears and dreams, Cavalier and Clay create The Escapist, The Monitor, and Luna Moth, inspired by the beautiful Rosa Saks, who will become linked by powerful ties to both men. With exhilarating style and grace, Michael Chabon tells an unforgettable story about American romance and possibility. Or, The Storied Life of A.J. Fickrey by Gabriella Zavine. We are not quite novels. We are not quite short stories. In the end, we are collected works. A.J. Fickrey's life is not at all what he expected it to be. His wife has died. His bookstore is experiencing the worst sales in its history. And now his prized possession, a rare collection of Poe poems, has been stolen. Slowly but surely, he is isolating himself from all the people of Alice Island. From Chief Lambes, the well-intentioned police officer who's always felt kindly towards him, from Ismay, his sister-in-law, who is hell-bent on saving AJ from his dreary self. From Amelia, the lovely and idealistic, if eccentric, nightly press sales rep who persists in taking the ferry to Alice Island, refusing to be deterred by AJ's bad attitude. Even the books in his store have stopped holding pleasure for him. These days, he can only see them as a sign of a world that is changing too rapidly. And then, a mysterious package appears at the bookstore. It's a small package, though large in weight, an unexpected arrival that gives AJ the opportunity to make his life over, the ability to see everything anew. It doesn't take long for the locals to notice the change overcoming AJ, for the determined sales rep, Amelia, to see her curmudgeonly client in a new light, for the wisdom of all those books to become again the lifeblood of AJ's world, or for everything to twist again into a new vision of his life that he didn't see coming. Or, Ella Minow P. by Mark Dunn. Ella Minow P. is a girl living happily on the fictional island of Nolup off the coast of South Carolina. Nolup was named after Nevin Nolup, author of the immortal Pangram, "The quick brown fox jumps over the lazy dog." Now Ella finds herself acting to save her friends, family, and fellow citizens from the encroaching totalitarianism of the island's council, which has banned the use of certain letters of the alphabet as they fall from a memorial statue of Nevin Nolup. As the letters progressively drop from the statue, they also disappear from the novel. The result is both a hilarious and moving story of one girl's fight for freedom of expression, as well as a linguistic tour de force sure to delight word lovers everywhere. Note: a pangram is a sentence or phrase that includes all the letters of the alphabet. Bonus segment! My personal favorite Goodreads list, Dear Committee Members, is on is interesting, well-written books that are not by dead, old white men. Happy reading, everyone! Today's library tidbit comes to us from Marie Silverman. Mrs. Silverman is at the library to give a talk about her experiences as a Holocaust survivor and a refugee. She has graciously come on the podcast today to talk with us. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start. Just tell me a little bit about your childhood and what you remember.
Well, I was born in Lens, Pas-de-Calais, France, and for some reason or other, we left there and went to live in Antwerp, Belgium, where my father had a sister who lived there. My sister, Jeanette, was born in Antwerp, Belgium, and we had a very interesting and beautiful life. I went to school, and I also had the pleasure of having violin lessons. And until the war started, the Nazis invaded Belgium, Antwerp.
Did your family have any expectation? Did they know that this was coming? How much awareness within the Jewish population in Belgium was there that this was coming, that this was a danger?
Well, let me say that my mother took my sister and I to visit our grandparents in Hungary and Czechoslovakia during summer vacation, and we left early. Therefore, there was a sign that things were brewing. But otherwise, I did not know. My parents shielded me from all the horrible things that were transpiring.
And you left Belgium when you were 9?
Yes.
And you guys left on a train?
Yes, but when the bombs started falling, we walked or ran to the train station with bare necessities. And we were lucky to board a train heading towards France.
You had mentioned in a previous interview that I had read that there were checkpoints looking for Jewish escapees along that train track. How do you know how your parents were able to shield you and keep you guys from being discovered, or is it just sort of luck?
I guess it was just luck, and that my parents made us be quiet, behave, and just
don't stand out, that sort
and not to speak with anyone. So that's...
You were 9. How old was your sister?
My sister was 5 and a half.
That must have been quite a challenge. Those are both rambunctious ages.
Exactly. Especially my sister was a little devil.
Oh, yeah.
So it was. But they managed to keep us in tow. My parents I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. And did notice that the train was like going and coming back, going smoke screens.
Oh, wow.
And I questioned my parents about that. And I got a very mundane answer. Mm-hmm. You know, just that this is the way it has to be. So but that's what it was. Smokescreen.
So, yeah, up until that, even at that point, your parents had not told you what the reality of what was happening.
No. Wow. No.
But you knew, did you know that the bombs were falling, or did your parents just grab you and go and you were very confused?
Of course. Very confused. Yes. And yes, we did. They didn't say anything about it. It's just that they had to leave. Mm-hmm. We have to leave Belgium.
So you took the train. You ended up in Toulouse.
Right.
How close was that to where you were born?
I'm
just curious if your parents were just going to the closest, like wherever the train stopped, or why did they pick Toulouse? No.
I don't know why. They never told me. I never found out that it was just Toulouse. And Toulouse is, I would say, maybe a couple of hundred miles before Spain, you know, in the in the middle there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And yes, they chose Toulouse, and I don't know why. And why they stopped at a farmhouse, I don't know either. But we were very lucky to be able to hide in the cellar where farmers had their, you know, potatoes and all their goods. And we were not allowed to go out from there.
And what year was it that this happened?
This is 1940.
1940. That's fairly early into the war then.
Mm-hmm. Yes. But we... these people put their own lives in jeopardy by doing what they did. But there were so many that if it wasn't for these people who were upstanders, that we wouldn't be here.
And how long did you hide in the cellar before you were found?
We must have been there about 3 or 4 weeks until the Gestapo found us.
Mm-hmm. And then they sent you to Rivesaltes?
Right.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yes. That was a camp. Mm-hmm. And that was like probably 100, maybe 150 miles.
Oh, so they sent you
from Toulouse.
Quite a ways.
Mm-hmm. Yes. But my parents were with us at that point still.
In the camp?
Until we got to the camp.
Okay.
My mother and sister and I were in one barrack, and my father was sent elsewhere.
And then what was the day-to-day life like in the camp? What memories do you have or willing to share?
What memories were that the children were in one room. They gathered the children in one room and to keep us out of trouble. And... we weren't allowed to play outside.
Was it the Nazis that kept you in the room?
Yes.
Okay. I didn't
yes.
know if it was like the parents were like, your kids are going to stay in this room so that you, like, sight unseen, so that they sort of forget that you exist.
They made it sound like they were teaching us, you know, a classroom. Mm-hmm. But we never.
There was no teaching.
No
involved.
Teaching involved at all. Yeah. So, and it's so we just stayed there during the day, and then they brought us back to my mother. My mother, who was, you know, stayed in the barrack. Mm-hmm. What she did, I do not know. But okay. The barracks were horrible, that I know. Mm-hmm. And sanitation was minimal. And
do you remember food?
Food was soup and a piece of bread. Soup, if you would call it so, mainly, you know, I don't remember having anything in the soup.
And then your mother was able to escape at some point with you and your sister. How long do you know roughly were you in the camp before your mother made the escape?
We probably were there for about 4 months. About timing is, I don't have the timing, but I'm just giving you an approximate for probably 4 months. Until some of the resistant people were able to infiltrate the camp.
I was going to ask how your mother was able to facilitate this.
And my mother,
this.
The gutsy little lady that she was, got wind of them, and they instructed her what to do, how to get us out.
And then she went back for your father.
She had to go back, yes. First, she had to go back for a roll call, so to say.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And then she made her plans to find my father, because she didn't know where he was. But she managed to find him. But don't forget, prior to this, my mother dropped us off at the train station, as she was instructed to do,
wow.
and gave us to resistant people. You know, they were waiting there for us.
There's a lot of trust involved in your story. I mean, even so far, just trust that the people would help you in the cellar before the Gestapo found you, and then trust in the resistance that they are the resistance and that this isn't going to end up tragically.
It was no alternative.
Yeah, I was going to say, if the options are staying in those circumstances, or the possibility of escape.
Escape.
And not just escape for you, but escape for your children.
Mm-hmm. My mother, she wanted to make sure that we were safe.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, today I think there was a purpose of her trying to save us so that we can tell the story, you know?
Well, it's important
That's what I'm thinking of today. But at that time, I don't think that was in her mind. Her mind was just to save us, that we would be safe.
Mm-hmm. Was your mother always that strong of a woman, or did the circumstances that she found herself in, do you think that brought it out of her?
I think that the circumstances brought it out, because she was a warm, caring mother.
So you, as your 9-year-old, it's not something obeyed, that you would like.
Right.
Yeah.
Obeyed, or, you know, whatever. And we were both, you know, sheltered, but also loved and made sure that we did what needed to be done.
Your father did pass after he was smuggled out of Rivesalt.
Mm-hmm.
What happened between, like, how much time had passed and where were you guys staying between when that happened and then your mother smuggled you and your sister out to Spain, I believe?
That comes later on.
That comes much later.
Much
oh,
later
wow.
on.
So I am missing a whole chunk of your timeline.
Yes. From the, when we were given to these resistant people, my sister and I were given to these resistant people, they took us to a hiding place in Vence. That was a school that they had, that they gotten to do this, because there were other children that they got and brought to this hiding place. And my mother and father were, and I imagine that my mother was talking to these resistant people and saying, what do I do once I get a hold of my husband? Where do I go?
Mm-hmm.
Instructed her to go to Nice, a safe home. It's mm-hmm. called a safe home. And from there, they communicated with us through the resistant people, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And after a while, they decided it was time that they should come where we were, which they did undetected also. But it had to be with these men were gold. They finally came to where we were hiding, mm-hmm. which was a lovely place in the mountains in Vence. And but it wasn't long before my father passed away there,
mm-hmm.
because of the treatment that he was given, you know. And he escaped, and he passed away in Vence and was buried in Vence. But under a false name.
I was going to ask if you mm-hmm. know where his grave is, or if you had what markings.
And not under being Jewish.
Yeah, no, they couldn't.
No.
Yeah.
So he was buried under the name of Bizek and religion Protestant.
And is he, this is a very personal question, is he still buried there with that marking?
No.
Or have you changed the...
No.
That's dumb.
After the war, my mother took his remains and brought him to Metz, France, where her only surviving sister lived and had burial grounds. Mm. So that's where my father rests there now. At one point, when my husband and I went on a trip to France, we stopped and saw the grave, and, you know, so...
That was after you were in America, and so...
A whole lifetime after.
When your mother moved your father's remains, that was after you and your sister were already in America at that point.
Yes. Okay. Yes.
Mm-hmm. How long were you in hiding at the school before, and was it necessary to escape to Spain? Was the Nazi line coming, or was it just better than in hiding? France.
The whole hiding place in Vence was being moved because the Germans were quite near. They were in Italy, and Vence was near Italy. It's located
in those mountains at the border.
Yes. So these resistant people found a chateau in the middle of France. So they transported all of us. Little by little.
I was going to say, how do you move that many children? Because I'm imagining if it's a school, that's quite a few children.
There were quite a few, but there must have been about 50 to 75 children.
That's a
plus
lot.
Plus the adults. Mm-hmm. So they moved us all to Creuse, where... the people who owned the chateau relinquished it so that it would be a safe haven for the few Jews that they were going to hide there. Also in the mountains there. And, you know, being children, we thought, well, maybe this will be the end of our hiding and traveling, you know, with such caution. And not being children.
Yeah, not getting to play and always having to be worried. And
right.
How old were you at this point? Has a year passed or are you still 9?
At this point, I was almost 12.
Several years have passed then.
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yes, but there was so much more in between the story that...
Were you then still sheltered from the realities of what was happening, or were you more aware?
More aware why we had to do these things.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, yes. And why we had to be cautious and go by the rules that the people were giving you so that nothing would happen to us. It was quite a, you know... I speak quite a bit to children. And even now, as I'm talking, I'm there.
Mm-hmm.
I'm there. And I have goose pimples, you know, because of what... I imagine my children having to, you know, oh, God forbid, you know.
No children should ever have to... deal with that amount of trauma and that amount of horror. Like, it should never happen.
To be always scared and
to be
confused.
Just not being able to be children and not being able to just...
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So, but in this chateau, it was quite, you know, it was open. There was a lot of grounds that, but we had a certain area only to remain because also they were afraid. They don't know, they never knew.
You don't know, like, the people who are helping you, but you never know if their neighbors will help you or not.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Just the, the lack of trust in the people around you and whether or not they're going to help you live or if they're going to give you over to
you
die.
That's it. Yes. So now comes the rest is that the towns around there, the German were rounding up the Jews and they got the people, like my mother and all the people who were taking care of us, got wind of that. Mm-hmm. So my mother decided that it was time for us to be able to leave. And how this was managed, I have no idea. I never was able to ask my mother. Mm-hmm. My mother went with her stories to the grave because she would never reveal anything. But she got in touch with her sister-in-law and brother-in-law who escaped from Belgium to Spain to Barcelona. Mm-hmm. How she was able to, the only thing that I can figure is that she had a contact with a resistant person who knew where to contact my aunt and uncle.
Did your mom know that they had been able to escape to Spain?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yes. How? I don't know. So there's a lot of holes in my story.
Well, you were a young child, so.
And they call them courier, and they get paid for it. I mean, my aunt and uncle paid for it. Went to, sent this courier to the chateau that my mother, contacted and what have you. And that was a traumatic experience for my sister and I. And also, I figure my mother to
be separated.
Separated and send us away with somebody.
Yeah,
he didn't know.
With no way to keep in contact or to even let her know you'd arrived safely or...
There was this courier, so to speak, took us all the way down to the border of Spain and France. Mm-hmm. And then we crossed the Pyrenees. We walked. We heard gunshots around, and my sister's mouth was taped shut because she was crying. And the couriers were afraid
it would give you away.
Exactly.
So you guys had to walk over the mountains.
It was, at that time, it was a special route. Mm-hmm. If you remember, the scientists and the painters like Chagall, this is the route they took to escape. So this is the route that we were in until, all right, now back to the couriers that took us. We met our aunt and uncle, and they took over, and we were in Spain for about 6 months. Now I am already about 12, a little over 12 and a half. And we went to school. We went to a French school, and we learned a little English, not much, but a little. And from there, they decided they were going to go, try and get out of Spain. They were able to get visas for themselves to go to Canada. Canada wouldn't accept us because we were not their children. So they now have to make different arrangements to see where they could find visas for us to go to America, which they did. So we traveled to Portugal with them. We boarded a ship with them, and it took two weeks. We got to Philadelphia, and this is where the ship stopped, and Jeanette and I were left on the dock to wait for someone to pick us up. Can you imagine that? Even though I was 12.
Yeah. No, I can't imagine that happening.
Even now, and I picture myself there with my sister. We were crying.
Oh, I bet.
And finally, my aunt and uncle, they departed back to Canada.
Yeah, I was going to ask, so they got you and your sister visas to America, but they still just had visas to Canada.
Right. Through the American Council for Refugee Children, mm-hmm. something. They're the ones that picked us up. And we traveled to Newark, New Jersey, and we entered an orphanage. Okay. That's where we were for a couple of weeks till they tried to make arrangements for a foster home, which they did in Providence, Rhode Island.
I know there were a couple of different Jewish organizations in America that were trying to put together foster homes for Jewish children that were escaping and were refugees to place them with Jewish families.
Exactly. That's exactly what happened. They, through the Jewish Family Services in Rhode Island, mm-hmm. accepted us and found a foster home. Jeanette and I were in one foster home like that, but the foster home only agreed to have us for the summer. Okay, here we go again.
Yeah.
After the summer, Jeanette went in a different place. I went to the Goldsteins.
So they split you up again.
Again. They split. We never were split. This is Mm-mm. the first time we ever split. But we were in Providence, the both of us.
Okay. So Jeanette wasn't moved
far away.
Far away.
So we were able on weekends to be together. So, and you know, at that time, telephones cost money.
Yes.
You know, to make a telephone call. So you were not on the telephone jibber-jabbing, you know, to one another because it cost too much money. I'm still in touch with my foster sister now. Mm-hmm. In fact, she was here not too long ago.
So it was the Goldsteins.
Mm-hmm.
How long did you live with them?
Until I got married. So, of course, I went to school, you know, and graduated with honors, and I went to Bryan College, which was a business school. Yes, I had met my husband when my mother came. Oh,
yeah, I was going to say, because your mother did eventually get a visa into the United States. It just took
five years later. She couldn't get a visa. So it was 5 years later when she came. I mean, you know, we were little kids when we left her. Here we were. I already met.
You were almost a legal adult.
Yes.
Yeah.
I had a job already. And so anyways, but it was a good reunion. For my mother, I could feel for her. She was like bewildered. What happened to you?
Yeah. You know? Well, the last she'd seen you, you were this small young thing that she's just sending out into the world. How long were you out of contact with your mother, though?
5 years. Four years.
4 years?
One,
okay.
The first year we were in Providence, we were in touch with her, writing. Yeah.
Okay.
She got our address, and then we got a telegram first. So that was 1 year, whole year.
Did your mother ever tell you what had happened, like, to her in Europe, or did she not talk about that at all?
The only thing that I knew what happened to her was, in the meantime, she had to support herself. She was no longer with the group, you know, that was hiding her because the war was ending.
Mm-hmm.
She got a job as a nanny. And that's how she supported herself and was able to go to different agencies to be able to come to America.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the agency in Providence, Rhode Island also helped, you know, to try and get her over. But it was difficult at that time, very difficult.
Do you know why the U.S. government wouldn't let her have a visa with two children in the country?
Especially where they had... I mean, especially where she had children here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They just wouldn't. Quotas. There were quotas.
I'm guessing it happened to a lot of families, as it was, from what I understand of history, which you have lived, it was easier for children to get
right.
refugee status and come in and be fostered. Right. So, but still, just the separating of families is
horrible.
Yes.
Yes.
Was there any like support with the Jewish Family Services? Did you guys, when you came over after through going through all of this trauma, was there any support within the organizations that you met here for sort of processing that?
Oh no, they were.
Do you know if they like how much involvement they were able to give to each child?
They were involved totally because they had to keep track, not track, but they cared to see that we were being taken care of properly.
Well, and the documentation that this happened and what it happened and who it happened to is still very important.
Exactly, exactly. Mm-hmm. And they were instrumental, really, in bringing my mother over. Mm-hmm. My mother had to have sponsors for all this to show the whoever, the government agencies in France, that she's going to have a job here, which she did. Somebody gave her, I mean, made sure a jewelry company mm-hmm. sponsored her. Another sponsored her trip, money to bring her over. These all had to be connected through the family services. And then when my mother was here, they made sure that she had a place to live. She just didn't come. And even though they wanted her, the foster homes, both foster homes, Jeanette's and mine, wouldn't have minded if she stayed. Mm-hmm. But no, she had to have a space of her own, according to the...
That was one of the stipulations by exactly. the U.S. government.
So, but we, Jeanette lived with, Jeanette was young enough, so she lived with mother for a while in her apartment and always in contact with the foster people. I mean, they didn't give up because mother was there. And I already, you know, was going to get married. And that was another traumatic thing that hit my mother already.
Oh, yeah. Reconnecting. And oh, yeah, by the way. Yes. Here's the man I'm marrying.
But my husband was the greatest son-in-law ever. I mean, he loved her. He really did. And he loved me. I think he gave me the support to carry on, you know, as a human being. Mm-hmm. Does that sound right? As a person.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He's a good man.
You mentioned at the beginning that you guys took a trip then to France and right. saw your father's graves. Then did you travel like back through the same route that you had escaped through?
Yes, we went to the chateau, and also we went all the way down to Vence I wanted him to see that, but I couldn't go into the Rivesaltes.
No. Did you find it at all healing, or was it just good for you to share that experience with your husband?
I wanted to share with him, and he was happy to be part of my life now. Mm-hmm. We went to the chateau, and on the way there, we stopped at a gas station, and we asked the woman there whether anybody comes to the chateau, and she started talking to us. And I speak French, so I could speak with her. And she said, oh, we remember, we were hiding people in our farm. So she knew the whole situation, what was going on. She said, yes, there are people that come and visit the chateau. I left my name and address there. And now I'm in contact with a friend in France through email. So we, you know.
With just with her or with somebody else who had hidden with you?
Yeah, someone that was hidden with us there.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. You know, we don't share too much of a story back and forth, but we do connect, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's nice. So I did meet someone.
Have you been able to connect with fellow survivors at all and sort of people who've been through similar experiences that you have?
All the time. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, through the Holocaust Museum, you mm-hmm. meet people all the time that were there. Gulf Coast Family Services mm-hmm. has a program for Holocaust survivors. And I'm on the advisory committee on that program. So I meet a lot of people.
So do you volunteer then with the Florida Holocaust Museum? I know you've given several speeches there, mm-hmm. but you also volunteer at the museum, or are you on a board anywhere with them?
I volunteer at the museum, yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. And I speak there. Mm-hmm. And through them, I have different schools that I go to speak.
And how long did it take you, roughly, to be able to put together your story and be comfortable with sharing it? Because you share it, I mean, with the Florida Holocaust Museum, mm-hmm. you share it with schools, talk to a lot of children, I know. Right. But it can't be easy to talk about it.
No. When the Holocaust Museum in St. Pete, mm-hmm. organized on Fifth Street, and they were, you know, organized, and they wanted docents. I wouldn't do a docent, but my husband did. My husband was a docent, and one day he came home, he says, you know, it's time that you put your story together and go out and share. And that's how it all started. So I wrote it up and tried to get more information, verify mm-hmm. what I'm saying, that it is what it is. So I contacted a lot of people that were in the know, you know. So, and I had a friend who was a law editor, you know. She writes, okay. She edited it for me, made sure that it was... So that's how it all became, and that's how I tell my story. And I tell it in time-wise, year-wise, not from here to there to upstairs, you know? Mm-hmm. It's all categorized in the proper way that we survived.
We're very grateful that you are coming and speaking at the library. We're grateful that you share your story in general. It's really important to have people who have survived genocides talk about their experiences and have that in the historical record for people who haven't experienced that, to be able to know what happens and who, like, that it's people that it's happening to, and it's children that it's happening to. So, right.
But that there are righteous people.
Mm-hmm.
Who
that you can also, like, there are people who will help, and that you can help, and that you should help if this mm-hmm. happens and you
exactly.
see it.
Otherwise, I wouldn't be here.
Thank you. Thank you so much for coming and talking with me and doing this interview and sharing your story.
You made it easy for me. I was a little scared, but you made it easy. Thank you.
And now it's time for Book Traveler with Victor.
Bienvenido a una nueva edición de Viajero de Libros. Mi nombre es Victor y soy el bibliotecario en la comunidad de la Biblioteca Pública de Largo. Hoy les voy a hablar sobre un título que tenemos en la colección en español que se titula Stranger, el desafío de un inmigrante en la era de Trump, por Jorge Ramos. La sinopsis. Jorge Ramos es un periodista galardonado con premios Emmy, reconocido presentador del noticiero Univisión y considerado la voz de sin voz de la comunidad latina. Fue expulsado de una rueda de prensa del candidato presidencial Donald Trump en Iowa en el año 2015, tras cuestionar sus planes sobre inmigración. En este manifiesto personal, Ramos explora qué significa ser un inmigrante latino, o simplemente un inmigrante en los Estados Unidos de nuestros días. Mediante datos y estadísticas, su olfato para encontrar historias y su propia memoria personal, Ramos nos muestra el rostro cambiante de América y explora las razones por las que él y muchos otros millones de inmigrantes aún se sienten como extraños en este país. Mi opinión. Si no eres espectador de Univisión, es posible que no estés familiarizado con Jorge Ramos. Es presentador de noticias y reportero. Ramos se lanzó a la fama en el público anglosajón por haber sido expulsado de una importante conferencia de prensa durante la temporada de Iowa Caucus por hacerle al candidato Donald Trump demasiadas preguntas puntuales sobre el elemento central de su campaña, que era el muro. Ramos nació y creció en la Ciudad de México, pero se mudó a Estados Unidos para recibir su capacitación personalizada de periodista y en busca de la oportunidad de ser más libre en su práctica periodística. Tuvo suerte en el periodismo, pero no lo ha logrado y le ha ido bastante bien. También se ha convertido en ciudadano estadounidense. Ramos aborda la historia en la conferencia de prensa de inmediato. No es tan dramático como se ve en la televisión, porque el futuro presidente le permitió volver a la conferencia de prensa e hizo una entrevista privada con Ramos después. Este momento estableció un par de precedentes, sin embargo. Trump y la prensa han tenido una relación difícil, por decirlo suavemente. También se estableció otro precedente. Mientras Ramos se enfriaba los talones fuera de la conferencia de prensa, un partidario de Trump con un sombrero rojo le dijo a Ramos, «Sal de mi país». Ramos le informó que él era ciudadano estadounidense, solo para que le dijeran lo que sea. Por primera vez en años, Ramos se sintió que realmente era un extraño en un país de adopción, de ahí el título del libro. Ramos se basa en este último incidente por un tiempo, discutiendo cómo el comportamiento y los comentarios del presidente han alentado a muchos a actuar, sintiendo un cambio en el clima político. También habla sobre las desigualdades de derechos civiles para los hispanos, sus propias experiencias en su mayoría positivas, y cómo el clima político actual es desorientador para un hombre que ha vivido más de la mitad de su vida en Estados Unidos y pensó que lo sabía todo. Ramos también habla sobre cómo vive en dos mundos, con doble ciudadanía estadounidense y mexicana. Con frecuencia cubre México para sus redes y pasa días enteros hablando español o inglés. La mayor parte de su familia está en México, pero sus hijos nacieron y se crearon en los Estados Unidos. Ramos también incluye varios ensayos que han escrito para otras publicaciones sobre este tema. Para los que piensan que Ramos solo critica al presidente y nada más, también critica al ahora presidente saliente de México. Ramos incluye un extenso conjunto de notas finales. En general, el libro es una buena historia sobre Ramos y su experiencia de primera mano con el racismo, la discriminación y la política de Trump. Es todo por hoy. Hasta la próxima edición de Viajero de Libros. Adiós.
Thanks, Victor, for another great book review. Remember, if you happen to not know Spanish, check out the English language translation in the show notes. Have a great month, everyone. We hope to talk to you again soon. I never wrote a thing. Oh, curses. I didn't write a summary. Oh, I have to wing it. Wing, wing, wing. Dear committee members, is this...